Good evening. This is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My returning guest tonight is Polly Atkin. She's a multi-award-winning poet, essayist, nature writer, and academic. And we're talking about her book, Some of Us Just Fall, on nature and not getting better. Polly, welcome back to the show. It's a real pleasure, although I don't know if I should say that, to talk to you about this book.
It's a real pleasure to be here. And I think it's okay. It's okay to say it's a pleasure, even though the book has some difficult content. You know, it's cathartic, I think, for readers sometimes to read it, even if it's also distressing.
Well, I was going to ask you about that. Was writing this book cathartic for you, did it change anything about how you felt about things? Like you had to finally get it down on paper and then reflected on it, and did it change?
It did, but through a very, very long process. So the writing of it was definitely not cathartic. If anything, it was re-traumatizing because I had to go back over things that a lot of the time I choose not to think about in my daily life in order to be able to get on with daily life. So particularly going back to my teenage years how distressing the episodes of misdiagnosis and undiagnosis were then, and going back and reading my diaries from that period, that was just triggering. There's no other way around it. I think there's something that happens in the process of then sharing it and it going out there, other people having their responses to it, that reminds you why you are sharing that and why you have gone back to those difficult episodes and want to share them with people, that then becomes something completely different. It becomes something not to do with you as a person anymore, but to do with something to do with millions of people. And that then becomes a kind of joyful thing.
And I can attest to that because I myself have a chronic illness, and I'm a person that loves to be outside, that loves to birdwatch. And so I didn't know what I have never read anything like a self-help book or anything like that. I wasn't sure what I was going to get out of it. And I got a lot out of this book in different ways. But you're right. I mean, my story is totally different from your story. Mm-hmm. But there are things that are tangential. And and it's important to hear the message to read the message that you put in this book. You write in the introduction that the book is about inheritance and continuity, and finding a way to go forward in life, knowing that what makes you sick is also what makes you you. Can you just elaborate on that? Because I identified that immediately as soon as I read that.
Yeah, so all of my life I've been struggling with some kind of illness, and in varying degrees at different points of my life. And for a lot of that time, I thought that it was a problem to do with me, that I wasn't responding in the right way to something, and that if I did in some way, if I changed something, that I would get better and everything would be fixed and it would be fine. And then finally, I got my diagnosis in my mid-30s, having been discharged from lots of clinics and told that there was absolutely nothing wrong with me apart from overthinking or whatever. You know, the old it's all in your head thing. Eventually then, you know, only a few months after that, I did then get my diagnosis, and I found that I had two genetic conditions. And that changed completely what I thought about my experience of those conditions, and particularly my experience of symptoms, to find out that actually they come from my genes, they come from my family, they come from everything that's brought me to be who I am, but also they're in me, in the very smallest part of me. You know, they're in the mitochondria of my DNA. So there's no, and they're incurable at the moment, but also there would be no way to remove them from me whilst retaining my selfhood, which isn't to say that I wish that I hadn't been diagnosed sooner and that I hadn't got as ill as I got and that I had better care. But that those conditions are a part of my very being.
It's the inheritance part that people never understand. When you try to explain to them, it's in your genes, and what the important. And it's, in that way, it's not like cancer where there's some cures that can make you better sometimes. And they don't get that they don't. I don't think. I swear it's because people have really bad science education.
Yeah, that probably doesn't help.
No, they don't understand what it means to have a genetic disorder. Now, getting back to your childhood, what was amazing is there were so many things going on in your childhood all the time.
Yeah, it seemed
pretty obvious that there was something wrong, but you fell and broke bones easily.
Yeah, easily. And I mean,
wasn't there a suspicion early on that, like, hey, there's something going on with the kid?
Well, the extraordinary thing was, because there were so many different things going on. I mean, part of this, and part of what I talk about more actually in the Owls book that I talked about less in here, is that alongside that period of my life from kind of toddlerhood to getting towards school, you know, I broke both of my legs, and then I carried on breaking other bones since. But I also was speaking my own made-up language as well. So on all these different fronts, you know, my mom is taking me to multiple doctors saying, look, I'm a third child as well. So my mom had had two other children before that. She'd also, my mom was a radiographer before she got married as well. So she'd worked in a hospital with people, or in various hospitals with lots of people who had had different accidents and stuff. And she had a degree of medical awareness. And she was going to all these doctors saying, look, there's something that's different about my child. Can you help? And all of them just going, nah, not really.
Right. Why don't you try over there and that doctor? Because maybe they'll have a different diagnosis.
And to the point where...
But, I mean, it's not like you're just feeling weak. You're actually breaking shit in your body. And it's happening.
And we'd get kind of simple things like eventually she paid for me to see a pediatrician because I also was walking with my feet turned entirely towards each other, like in a flat line, so my toes and my heels in a kind of straight line, and obviously tripping over them a lot and falling. And again, no one could really help with that. And she did in the end pay for me to go to see, because obviously in the UK we have the NHS, so most of my treatment, or lack of treatment, was free at least. But she paid for me to go and see someone privately who, again, was no better than anybody else, and just said, oh, you want to get her going to some gym classes and keeping exercising. And it was only after my diagnosis that then I got access to some of my digital records and looked back, and he'd put hypermobility down in my notes then in 1984.
Wow.
And not told anybody.
Well, keep it on the down low.
Yeah. Don't tell the patient. Don't tell the patient's parents. Don't tell anyone who might be able to help. Just say, go to gym classes.
Well, first of all, imagine the consequences of going to gym classes. You would have broken lots of stuff. And you did.
Yeah.
You did.
Yeah.
So as that young person, at what point in your life did you realize, okay, they're not helping at this point? They're not really helping out. Did you still have faith in them figuring out what was going on? Like,
yeah, I mean,
I'm trying to figure out where that happened in your childhood into adolescence or adulthood.
Especially in that kind of middle period, so like going into kind of preteen and then teenagerhood, when I was in these multiple consultations and hearing all these doctors say, oh, you just need to lose weight, or you need to do more exercise, or you need to do no exercise, or you need to do these exercises, or you need to do that, or you need to eat this, or you need to eat that. And I did think that I think I had a faith that if we just got the right jigsaw piece, you know, it would all slot into place and everything would make sense. And that maybe we were just seeing the wrong people over and over and over and over again. But I definitely didn't have faith in those particular people. But then what else are you meant to do? And I think it's really difficult. It's difficult as a child working out how to gain agency in that system. And it wasn't really until I'd had horrific experiences then when I was in my late teens of being sent down this psychology route where I ended up with someone who considered himself a world expert on eating disorders.
Oh, God.
Who would try to convince me that all of my problems were because my dad's business was failing. And I, that was the lowest point for me, because I'd gone through every process. I'd been told by a hematologist that there was definitely something wrong with me. They just couldn't work out what, and never to let anybody tell me that I was inventing my symptoms, because he could see that there was blood work that proved that something was happening. They just didn't know what. And then I still ended up with my only treatment being this guy who wanted me to agree with him,
right,
that I was creating my own symptoms because I was upset about my dad's business, which, quite frankly, I couldn't have cared less about.
And then I'm sure the attitude was, if you only agreed with me, you'll be better.
Yes.
There's, yeah, that's diabolical.
Yeah, it was. And in the end, like, I saw him by myself the first time, because in some ways I was quite like, you know, I was 17 and I thought, oh, I don't know, maybe, you know, therapy wasn't a very usual thing in the UK back then in the 90s. And I thought, well, yeah, it might be quite nice to see someone and talk about myself. And got in there, and after that first session was the only time that I thought, I can't go on, actually. I can't continue living like this. So the next time I took my mum in with me, and we only saw that guy three times and kind of discharged ourselves at the end of it. And at the end of it, he kind of wrote a note going, she seems to be better. I don't know why. I guess it's something I did.
Oh. The amazing thing is, what was your teenage, and you write a lot about this, there's some sections in this book where about the caves, which
yes,
I found, the Creswell Crags area, that almost seemed oneric. They almost seemed like dreams.
Yeah.
I wanted to talk to you, expand on what it was, because going through those years as a teenager are fraught with all sorts of complications anyways. Mm-hmm. What was it like for you to have all this layered on top of what's already going on?
Well, the weird thing is, when you're going through something, it's just your life, isn't it? So you don't have a way of looking at it at the time and thinking how, really of understanding how strange it is, I think, especially when you're a child and when you are a teenager as well. And I think the funny thing about inherited conditions as well, I'm the first person in my family who was diagnosed with Ehlers-Danlos and with hemochromatosis.
Yep.
But obviously there's generations and generations of people with symptoms that, because everybody in the family has them to some degree or other, you normalize. And the landscape was like that too. So I grew up in Nottingham, which everybody knows mostly because of Robin Hood and the Sheriff of Nottingham. But it is what people don't know about it is that it is a city built on sandstone, and there is an extraordinary cave network underneath the city. So you can go and visit these caves now, and people lived in them up until the kind of beginning of the 20th century. But they're also, you know, there's pubs built into them. There's some very famous caves that people escaped in during the Civil War and things like that. So there's this whole kind of strange subterranean city under the city that connects all these different things. But when you grow up with it, it's just normal. And it's part of the reason I wanted to bring it in, because it is, for me, it became like thinking about my body. Once I understood that my conditions were genetic and that they were there in the very smallest part of me and had been there all the time and had been there in my family, the caves became this amazing metaphor for thinking about what is underneath us all the time. And it's just part of our existence that we don't recognize as being different to other people's experiences until we see those other experiences.
It was like the passage to India. I mean, it was this weird thing where the caves had all sorts of weird overlaps of symbolism and stuff like that. And it's funny that you went back and revisited them. And it wasn't the same. You were not correctly diagnosed till you were 34.
Yeah.
And then you were finally diagnosed as having hypermobile Ehlers-Danlos syndrome, mm-hmm. and then hemochromatosis.
Yeah, that's right.
Also often called the Celtic curse.
Yeah.
And you try to track that down, which is another whole part of the book. Was it an incredible relief to you to finally arrive at the diagnosis?
Yeah, an extraordinary relief. That
even though it didn't mean anything to you feeling better, psychologically.
No, but it knowing, and I think that the validation of knowing what it was, and that there were so many people who had told me, especially in that kind of last 4 years, so the kind of first half of my 30s, because I started to get very ill again around the age of 29 and just had a kind of downward trajectory until my eventual diagnosis. And I had seen so many doctors in that time who had told me either there was nothing wrong with me at all and I was just being oversensitive, like that's a quote, or that there was no point in trying to seek diagnosis because there was nothing anyone could do about it anyway. And to have someone, as soon as I walked in the consulting room with, it was Professor Rodney Graham, who's since retired, who was a Ehlers-Danlos expert who diagnosed me. And as soon as I walked in the room, he looked at me and knew. And I could see him looking at me and going, oh, okay, even before he started doing all the tests. And to have that kind of validation of someone looking at you and actually seeing you for what you are after so many decades of people saying, no, that's not happening. You say that's happening, but it can't possibly be happening. Was just extraordinary. And the relief of that, like I write in the book, I went into the loo in the hospital afterwards and I just wept with sheer relief of knowing that there was a name for what I was experiencing.
Well, as you were talking about, there are exterior symptoms that people could look at you if they knew what to look for.
Yeah.
That could read you and say, yes, you definitely have this.
Yeah, completely. And both of these conditions, like so many conditions, are considered invisible illnesses often, but actually they're not at all. And I look at people all the time now and think, oh, just as Professor Graham was doing to me. You know, when you know what to look for, you can see it in other people. And I think it's very lazy to call such conditions invisible when often they are. Even pain is very visible, isn't it, when you know what it looks like.
But people can't see, you know, your surrounding people that are around you, they can't see pain, and oftentimes they don't know how to what you're going through for the experience or how deep the pain is, how serious the pain is.
But I think if you've experienced pain like that yourself, you can see it in other people.
Yes, you can.
Yep. And that's the difference. And I think it's a laziness about what we're perceiving of other people that allows us to call these conditions invisible when they're not.
Yeah, but I think there's also this culture of like, just slap a smile on and you'll feel better, which is so effing, like, you just want to punch somebody. You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My returning guest tonight is Polly Atkin. She's a multi-award-winning poet, essayist, nature writer, academic, and we've been talking about her book, Some of Us Just Fall, on nature and not getting better. Once you got a diagnosis, it was interesting. Then you started to analyze what it's like to live a chronic life.
Yeah.
And all the things it does. What happens with time and personal sense of time in the chronic life?
I think time with chronic diseases is so fascinating. I mean, the whole root of chronic is in this idea of time. So a chronic condition is a condition that is to do with time, and it just goes on and on. And I talk in the book about this concept of crypt time as well, which emerged through disability studies as an academic discipline of what time in the disabled body and through disabled experience does as well. But there's something so fascinating, I think, about I think anybody who lives with an energy-limiting condition, with pain, with any kind of disability that means that you have to do things in a different way, knows how that distorts time. And you will often hear people saying that, you know, we have a different 24 hours to able-bodied people. And I think that's entirely true. But I think there's also something about that I started to think about connective tissue disorders, particularly, and how connective tissue works and the connective tissue of time and how your sense of time might be entirely disrupted or entirely altered if your body is built differently as well.
I understood that. I think that made sense to me. The other thing is, a huge section of this happened during COVID lockdown.
Yeah.
It's like, could you add one more thing on top of it?
Yeah. So
ultimately, was that a good thing or a bad thing? Because at that point, you're living in Grasmere, right?
Yeah. But I had been for quite a lot of the time that I was writing this book in. So I actually wrote, the first draft of this book was completed in 2018, before COVID was even a blip on most of our radars. But I couldn't find an agent and I couldn't find an editor. So by the time I did get to that point, so I got my agent in 2021. Obviously, by then, we had been living through this very strange experience where suddenly everybody's lives were limited by illness for a very short period. as I say in the book, people suddenly were saying to me, I couldn't live like this, not being able to go out whenever I want to go out. I simply couldn't live like this. And I realized that they were talking about a period of time that was shorter than the time that I had plaster casts on for most of my broken bones, and that they were saying their lives were unbearable. And what that started to tell me about the way that people perceive disability and chronic illness. And there was this moment, I think, at the beginning in the lockdowns where, you know, that pan-banging moment, that we're all in it togetherness, where there was this kind of moment of hope of thinking, oh, wow, people care and they understand. And then suddenly, as soon as they could, everybody who could just went back to their normal lives and forgot about those of us who can't. and not even forgot about us, but we became a trigger for them for uncomfortable things they didn't want to think about, where they're just like, no, I don't want to think about that. Don't talk to me about illness. Don't talk to me about disability.
So you became a symbolic leper.
Yeah, completely. And that's the moment that I was editing the book into and thinking, wow, I can't not include some of that in the book as well, because it's such a strange manifestation of what I was already writing about.
We're going to run out of time, but that's okay. you write about the nature cure in a way that I thought was really special. Talk about that.
Yeah, so one of the motivations for me in writing this book, I'd been living in the Lake District I moved up here to the Lake District in 2006, 2007 to do PhD study. And it was at the end of that time, so 2009, 2010, when I started to get more ill again. And then I carried on, I moved back up here, and I was living here during the time when I was so ill. I didn't know what I was going to do. There were times when I couldn't really get around the house, let alone anything else. I was in extraordinary pain all of the time, and people were telling me there was nothing wrong with me. At the same time, in the mid-2010s, that this idea of the nature cure was really taking root in nature writing in the UK, certainly. And one of the things that I love to do in the Lake District is swim outdoors. I love to swim. It's one of the few times when I am released from what I call the tyranny of gravity, which is my biggest enemy in many ways, where I feel more comfortable in the water than I do doing anything else at all. And every single piece of writing about wild swimming that I came across, apart from at that time, Jessica Lee's book, Turning, was the only book that I found that didn't do this, wrote about wild swimming as a cure for absolutely anything.
Yeah, yeah.
And during the phase when I then started writing the book, it became even more dominant. And the Salt Pass, the year I was writing this and trying to get an agent, trying to get it published and failing to get it published, was the year that the Salt Pass, which is Raina Wynn's book about fictionally walking, a memoir, which is heavily fictionalized, about a walking cure for her husband for a neurodegenerative condition. Yeah. That year it was shortlisted for the Wainwright Prize. And I was sitting there thinking, that there is an urgency about writing about chronic conditions and how we have a relationship with nature which is full of joy, but does not in any way cure us. Otherwise, no one would be ill.
It just keeps, I think as he wrote in the book, nature just keeps going.
Yeah.
You can get a lot of positive momentary stuff from nature, and I do all the time. But at the end of the day, you're not better.
And also, you know, nature is full of horrible things as well.
Yeah.
You know, I moved here to study the Wordsworths and their legacy in the Lake District. And some of our ideas about the nature cure kind of come directly from Wordsworth and this idea of that he writes about let nature be your teacher. And that was taken up by Victorians and then kind of changed and changed and changed as it went along. But they knew better than anybody that nature could also destroy things. It could be a really strong destructive force, and it doesn't care about individual human beings at all. And this idea that we can go to nature and just, you know, lick a frog or hug a tree and everything will be better. There would be no disease and there would be no history of disease if that were true.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, it isn't. If it were that easy, none of us would ever be suffering with anything.
Nor would all the animals still be alive, too.
Exactly. Animals would get sick.
We're completely out of time. And we haven't even touched on the literary aspects of this book, too, because that's a part I really love. Thomas De Quincey. It's fascinating. That's a whole other aspect of this book, and people who are listening should realize there's a lot more that's in this book that we could possibly talk about. My returning guest tonight is Polly Atkin. She's a multi-award-winning poet, essayist, nature writer, and academic, and we've been talking about her book, Some of Us Just Fall, on Nature and Not Getting Better. Polly, it's a pleasure to talk to you again.
Thank you so much.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.